now detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the most enduring mysteries of all time. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. That's our topic of conversation today. Our guest is an archaeologist who refers to himself as a maverick. He is a host of an internet radio program and has been researching the unexplained and from the perspective of through a Christian lens for quite some time. And he is a part of a forthcoming documentary film called Finding Noah, The Search for Noah's Ark. It's our pleasure to welcome back to the bunker Dr. Aaron Judkins. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be on the program with you.
And my apologies for the clumsy introduction there. We'll make sure that we have a discussion before the end. You have an opportunity to tell people where to find your work. AaronJudkins.com, I know, is your website, but I know that also that there are a couple of other places out there. This has been a little kind of bit of a whirlwind week, and listeners who've been paying attention to View from the Bunker and PID Radio know that we're in the process of moving. So sometimes the things that I set up as in terms of like cheat sheets and notes get lost in the other paperwork, like listing contracts and movers, you know, quotes from movers and stuff. So anyway, but for the next hour, all that gets put to the side as we look at at what looks like a really fascinating project that you got involved with, Finding Noah, and we'll talk about that. But first, your interest in the topic of Noah's Ark and in your work as an archaeologist, what is it about this particular subject, the location of Noah's Ark and finding proof that the biblical story is not just a myth or a legend? What is it about that got you interested?
I think one of the most amazing things from an archaeological point of view is that if there's an ark that's discovered, just a wooden structure that matches the dimensions given in the scripture, and we can verify that empirically, scientifically, through archaeology, that would change everything we know. It should change everything we know. And because of that, it would really be one of the greatest archaeological finds ever. There has been archaeological finds throughout history that has changed the course of archaeology, therefore changing what we know. And because of that, it's the search that is really an important aspect of this, because most great finds have been found not by archaeologists and trained scientists. Most finds throughout history have been found by lay people. They've been found by the farmers and the workers. They've been found by people who have, you know, homes on land, and they've been found by Bedouin shepherds, which is really one of the fascinating finds that we know of. The Dead Sea Scrolls was found by two Bedouin shepherds, and one of the sheep got lost. It was up in a cave, and he simply took a rock and kind of threw it up in there to spook the animal out, and he heard something break. And he went to go investigate, and sure enough, there was pottery. One of the rock he had thrown hit a pottery jar, and it had broke. And that's how the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are probably one of the most important archaeological finds that we know of to date, because it verifies every book in your Old Testament, with the exception of one book, and that's the book of Esther, I believe. But every book of the Old Testament has been verified. We don't have the original writings of Paul and John and, you know, all those guys anymore. We don't have the originals of the Old Testament, but we do have copies of them throughout history. And what the Dead Sea Scrolls did through archaeology was confirm the veracity and the authenticity of Scripture. And that is huge, because we have had a lot of people throughout time saying, well, the Christians, you know, their religion is really a blend of Gnosticism and, you know, Spiritism, and that's all blended in. And it really has its roots in paganism. And you hear a lot of these counter arguments against the Bible. And when you find the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's something you can hang your head on and say, wait a minute, the Dead Sea Scrolls are 2,000 years old, and it verifies the Old Testament. Multiple copies of Isaiah and Psalms and numerous copies of Genesis, etc., was discovered in the some was in the old Paleo Hebrew, and some was in the modern block Hebrew that they still write in today. As a matter of fact, in my office here, I have a copy of the scroll of Isaiah. It's the full copy in a scroll. Now it's a replica, but it's the full scroll, the full copy of Isaiah. And what this does is to show that, yes, this is it's authentic, and it's something empirical. And so that's what, in essence, finding Noah's Ark would do. It would verify the Scripture, again, confirming the book of Genesis in this case, that indeed there was a flood, and there was a family named Noah and his family who went on a boat and survived Noah's flood, and that would confirm that story.
The story has analogs, parallels in other cultures. The Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, other ancient cultures or cultures of ancient stories of a flood that wiped out all but a family or a few people here and there. How widespread is that story? Where do we find variations of the story of Noah and the flood?
Oh, you can find stories all over in almost every culture. We know of some estimates are as high as 500 ubiquitous flood stories around the earth.
Wow.
Now, some say it's lower than that. Some say it's about half. But as high as 500 ubiquitous flood stories that is in cultures today. And it's interesting. They all have a little different detail to them. They all have their own Noah. And they all have their own boat. It's a little bit different in some cases. But the thread, the central theme of the story is the same. And that is a man named Noah and his family survived a flood in a boat. I think it's very interesting that the Chinese language has a hidden message in that, if you will, confirming this. I write about it in the journal that I did on the search for the Ark. And when I was studying for this, I read everything I could, the history of the searches for the Ark and the people who went before me to get the knowledge that I needed so I would be up to speed on the current research. And one of the things I found was that in the Chinese language, that it's pictographical in essence, and the word for Noah in the current Chinese language means from whom the weed curse is removed. And I thought that was very interesting.
The weed curse?
The weed curse. Now, we know the weed curse as one of the things that we read in the book of Genesis when sin was introduced, right? That there was things that happened. That there was a curse on the serpent, and then the whole creation groans because of sin. Man would work from the sweat of his brow, and you know, women would endure child labor and these things. But one of the things we know of is that weeds would grow up out of the ground, right? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be as fruitful as it was because sin has entered the whole creation, not just in man, but the whole creation. But in the Chinese language, it means, Noah means, from the man from whom the weed curse is removed. In other words, there's a tie to that very specifically that they recognize that there's some kind of a tie to that back in their history. Again, we're talking about flood legends around the earth, and certainly the Chinese had theirs. It's also interesting that their word for boat, and I think I want to say it's a large ship in Chinese. The word for large ship, here it is. When you break it down, it's eight plus person plus boat.
Oh, as in the eight people who were saved on the ark.
That's right. And, wow. it's very powerful. A very powerful testimony embedded in the Chinese language, and this is one of the most obvious ones that we can look at. Now, I think there's a book written on this. I've never read it, but there's a book written about the Chinese language that details a lot of this. If I can find the name of that book, I'll mention it while we're on the air. But it's just an amazing confirmation that indeed these flood legends, there's something to them. There's a basis in history. Although they've changed throughout time, there's a basis of truth in these legends. I was over in Machu Picchu, Peru, a year ago, and even the Incas have a flood legend. And when you're in Machu Picchu, Peru, they have a stone that's up there, one of the sites. It's kind of, this whole place in Machu Picchu was lost to time for some 500 years, and it's exactly the way it was. The conquistadors never found it, thank goodness, because it was untouched, and so it's just sitting the way it was, and it's just remarkable to go visit there. It's one of my favorite places, but they have a stone there. And the stone was placed there because they said that they wanted to tie – the story is they wanted to tie that stone to the sun so there would not be any more earth calamities such as the flood. And so according to to what they knew is that this would help. But we know that indeed the flood was global. It covered the earth, and we have these flood legends around the world to show that indeed something did happen catastrophic in the past.
People have been looking for the ark for a long time, and there have been some reports that, even especially since the age of the airplane, where explorers were able to overfly areas where the ark might have come to rest and take photographs to kind of guide the search, maybe look for anomalies that would provide a starting point for research. But to the best of my knowledge, nothing nothing yet has really paid off. I know there've been some claims of petrified wood being found in places where it shouldn't have existed and things like that. But to date, the Ark has evaded detection. First of all, the area that we're told in the Bible, Mount Ararat, may not be – the area that we know today as Mount Ararat may not be what was referred to in the book of Genesis. It may have been like the mountains of Ararat. In other words, there may be a bigger region than the Mount Ararat that is located on the maps today. When beginning to plan an expedition – what sources do you draw upon to try to narrow the search and give you the best chance of success?
Okay, well, there's a lot of things that we've utilized. I have to say, this expedition that we were on was probably the greatest scientific search for Noah's Ark up to date. And the reason I say that is because we had a lot of science that we used for this expedition. We had a number, and I believe in a multidisciplinary approach. So you bring in other archaeologists, other geologists, people that are in different fields, and you attack it from all angles, mm-hmm. and that includes you know, people like Dr. Randall Price and others who have been involved in the search. And what we did was we knew the history of where ARC researchers had gone and reported sightings of seeing something. We targeted those areas by satellite, and there was some declassification of some satellite photos from NASA, and we were able to obtain those satellite photos. Matter of fact, one of those photos was labeled anomaly on Ararat. It's interesting. I'll tell you a quick story. One of my friends is a retired Marine, and he served back in the 80s, back during President Reagan's administration. His job was to look at photographs and recon those photographs. He was an expert in that, and he would occasionally brief the president. He told me one time he briefed Reagan on some materials as part of the daily defense that they the president would have
gets a daily intelligence briefing, right? Mm-hmm.
And one day he had gone back to the Pentagon where he was stationed, and his job was to go through a stack of these photographs, you know, and look at them. And his commander was running late one day, so he thought he would just kind of start flipping through these photographs and start looking at these. And as he did, he came across one that was Greater Ararat in eastern Turkey. And as he flipped through it, he looked at it, he glanced at it, and it said anomaly on Ararat. And he put it to the side. And then he said, "Wonder what that's doing in here." And he just kind of laid it over to the side and kept going through the other photos. And then he went, "Hmm." And he reached over and picked up the photograph and looked at it again. And he said seconds later, his commander walked in, reached over his shoulder from behind him, pulled the photograph, and he said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "Nothing, sir." And he said, "That's exactly right." And they kept going on with the other photos. I asked him, I said, what did you see in that photograph?" He said, "I saw a wooden object that had three levels in it." And he said, "I could tell you that it was a wooden structure." And I said, "What did it have labeled by it?" He said, "It said anomaly on Ararat." And that's exactly the photograph that eventually was declassified.
Hmm.
So we're looking at satellite imagery. We're looking at various aerial photography. We're also utilizing ground-penetrating radar in 3D. And of course, you know, that equipment has to be hauled up to the summit and then on top, you know, around to the site so it can be utilized. And I have to tell you, that's a lot of luggage just with that equipment to get up there. I think we broke the record. We had like over 40 pieces of luggage with scientific equipment that we hauled up to the summit. So that's a lot of equipment, a lot of things that has to be done. We have to grid that area out. We have to survey it. And then any anomaly that we came across under that ice, because you're on top of a glacier on the eastern plateau. And look, you know, it's not a matter of just getting up there and looking around. You have to look under the ice. And the only way you can do that is with that ground-penetrating radar. Then you have to plug that information in. You have to, you know, put it through a computer, and it has to be read and sent back. And then when you look at it, you say, okay, well, here's an anomaly that's not that we don't know what it is. We have to investigate that, and then you go in with your ice core drills, and that takes a drill team.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, when you're operating at nearly 17,000 feet with only a few hours of good weather, it is laborious, intensive work.
I can only imagine.
It really is.
You have to pack all that stuff in manually. I mean, am I correct? I mean, you can't like fly a helicopter up to the site and just, you know, drop everything off there.
No, you can't. We've had people ask, you know, well, why can't you do that? Well, it has been done in the past with fixed wing, with helicopters. But historically, it's been very difficult because the geopolitical area in the region is very volatile. And in the past, there's been conflict between the people that are on the mountain with the Kurdish freedom fighters and the Turkish military. And so in the past, they would just shoot you out of the sky, mm-hmm. you know, because that's a strategic place, you know, of military control, and it borders Syria and
Iran.
And it's just a very unsafe place. It has been in the past. One of our researchers in the past who actually climbed with Colonel Jim Irwin. He was our mm-hmm. Apollo 15 astronaut, eighth person to walk on the moon. And Colonel Irwin was so convinced that he flew over a structure when he was in the military. He said he flew over Greater Ararat, and he saw something down there. When he retired out of the military, NASA, he spent the rest of his life searching for Noah's Ark, searching for what he saw when he flew over. And he took about six climbs up Ararat and nearly died on one of those expeditions. He fell. They couldn't get to him. He had to overnight exposed to the elements. And they found him the next morning. They did not know if he was going to be alive. He was, but he was in bad shape. But one of the men who went with Colonel Irwin was John McIntosh. Mm-hmm. And John McIntosh used to go sometimes solo. And then he would go with Colonel Irwin. But one of the times they got captured at gunpoint. And this is back in the 80s. But, you know, early in the morning, you know, somebody comes through your tent, you know, here's a barrel of a gun you're staring at the other end. So there's been a lot of difficulties about doing those things in the past. It's not a matter of just sort of going up there and looking for the thing. It's not quite that simple. But we've used a lot of the current science that we could throw at it, and we're, you know, we utilized all those different things.
Hmm. So how did you get involved with this particular expedition?
Well, it was curious that I was speaking in Houston, and one of the men who had been involved in the search, I knew him for a number of years, and he was speaking at the same event that I was. And so I said, hey, what's the current status? Because I knew they had been looking for all these seasons. And back in 2010, they invited me, and I circumstances were that I couldn't go. So I said, where are you at on the expedition? And he told me, and he said, this is maybe the last push for the Ark. We're going to give it everything we have, and we, you know, this may be it. So can you go? If you can go, we need you. And so I said, well, this may be the last, you know, expedition. I'm going to, you know, do everything I can to make a go of it. And it turns out that one of the producers in Los Angeles caught wind of this and had been talking to one of the producers about doing a reality show on archaeology.
Hmm.
And so they said, well, give me your top 10 list of where you want to go. And I gave them my top 10, and number one was Turkey. And they said, well, why do you want to go to Turkey? And I said, well, because we're going to search for Noah's Ark in the fall, and this is maybe the last, you know, big push for the Ark, and this is what we're doing. And so because of that, that led into, a film team deciding, hey, we want to go follow you guys, and we want to document this process and put it on film. And so some funding came in for that, and the way was made possible. And then, of course, you know, we had the film crew that was able to, you know, document this whole process. And that's part of what Finding Noah is about and will be coming out later this year. Mm.
So the team gets together. You're included as part of the team. You've got the research and the information from previous expeditions, the satellite imagery showing the anomaly on Mount Ararat. Was it decided that that to focus on Mount Ararat, or because I know that there are other locations out there, some of which aren't even in eastern Turkey, which would be within the ancient kingdom of Urartu.
That's a good point, actually, because you're right. The ancient kingdom of Urartu encompassed not only it covered Armenia, mm-hmm. it covered into Turkey, into parts of Iran. It was huge. It was a huge area.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting. We went into Armenia, and the Armenians really claim that mountain still, even though it's not considered, you know, in Armenia. It's in Turkey now, but they still love that mountain. That's in the backdrop of their view from that side, from the north. If you're looking at the mountain from the north, from the Armenian side, it's just spectacular. It really is. The people really embrace that in their culture. Mm-hmm. They embrace the story. So we found that you know, the mountains of Ararat is a mountain range,
right,
that goes through there, and that's what the scripture said, the mountains of Ararat, plural. Now, having said that, back in the 70s, and you have to understand, there's Greater Ararat, which is at almost 17,000 feet, and then there's Lesser Ararat right next to it, at about 14,000 feet or so.
Hmm.
And most of that area is just barren rock. There's not a unless you're on the northeast side or the western plateau side, then you start running into glaciers and ice crevasses and you know, a snow-capped glaciers on top of Greater Ararat. And that's why it's been very difficult to search, particularly on Greater Ararat. And then number two, you have the Hor Gorge, which is a whole other problem. But getting back to the region, back in the 70s, a man by the name of Ron Wyatt claimed that he found the Ark. Now, it's about 30 miles away across the valley, kind of up another mountain. And it's roughly the same length, and it has kind of a diamond shape to it. Ron got this idea from a 1960 Time article magazine. There was a NATO general who was doing aerial reconnaissance, and he photographed this area from a plane. When he came back, he was looking at the photos and thought maybe this was a ship of some type. Ron Wyatt got wind of that, and he went over there and found that site. And after multiple trips, he was convinced it was the Ark. Now, he took people with him, and after many years of taking other people with him, he finally convinced the government of Turkey this was the Ark, and that, you know, indeed, that they had found some things there. I don't agree with that. And the reason is, and I know there's a lot of Ron Wyatt supporters, because I get to ask this question all the time, why are you looking for Noah's Ark when it's already been found?
Yeah.
We went to the site. We did give it its due diligence, because we wanted to know, you know, personally, firsthand, you know, what was there. So we went, and we looked, and we studied this thing. And here, the bottom line is this, is that it is a natural formation, a geological formation. It is not a boat. Now, that doesn't mean that over history people didn't utilize that as a defensive position, or there was not some type of human habitation in that area. But it doesn't mean that it's a boat, because it's not. There's, I know the evidence, you know, that they say that there's wooden timbers and there's metal rivets, and they found these things. But look, the truth of the matter is that it's a natural formation. And number two is that site's never been excavated. It just hasn't. They won't allow it. Ron did some ground-penetrating radar work back in the 80s with that technology. But the truth of it is that it's just not the Ark. If it was, I would have been the first one to jump up and down and plant the flag and say, here it is. Y'all boys have fun going climbing Greater Ararat at 17,000 feet. I'm not going, because it's here. And so, but it's not. Unfortunately, it's not. And I know there's people that will hold to that, and, you know, I guess that's fine. But look, they see pictures on the internet, and they read, you know, some something on the internet, and okay, that's enough evidence for them. But as an archaeologist and as a member of a scientific expedition, it's not enough evidence. As a matter of fact, it's very circumstantial evidence at that, but it's not enough to make any claims, especially of Noah's Ark. That doesn't mean that all of Ron's work is no good. I do find parts of his work interesting, and I'm open to some of those things. I just don't agree with the Noah's Ark finding. So we have targeted Greater Ararat very specifically. I know there's others who say it's not there. It's on Mount Judi in northern Iran. You're on the wrong mountain. What are you doing over there? It's on Mount Judi. And I know that there's people that's gone over there, such as Bob Cornuke and others, who have claimed that it's there.
Right, right.
I don't think it's there. Although that is in the ancient kingdom of Urartu. That is correct. But look, there's boulders and there's it's not snow-capped. You don't have a big hoar gorge there that's deeper than the Grand Canyon. It's searchable. The point is that by now it would have been found, and it's not found over there. And the reason is because it's not there. All the evidence is pointing to Greater Ararat. That's why we're concentrating there. Credible eyewitnesses, people like Colonel Jim Irwin, our Apollo astronaut. People like Ed Davis back in 1943, who was stationed over there during World War II for the Army Corps of Engineers, and he helped a village get water. And they wanted to honor him, and so they said, "We want to be able to take you up if the ark is visible." They call it the Holy Ark, by the way.
Hmm.
And if it's visible, we want to take you up there as a way to honor you, to saving our village. And the chieftain of the village was a boss, and he sent his grandsons up, and they said the ark was part of the ark was visible. Ed Davis got permission to take a few days of leave of absence, and they took him up there. Now, Ed Davis never told anyone of his story until he was well into his 80s. But what he did was write his testimony, his account in the first, blank pages of his Bible, in the cover of his Bible. And it was until later on, when Dr. Don Shockey, who started searching for the Ark in 1989-90-91, spoke at a church in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Ed Davis attended. And Ed Davis said, "I think I have something that you may be interested in," and gave his account. They went back through the weather records through 1943, and it shows that there was an ice melt in 1943 that would confirm Ed's story that he was able to go up to the Ark. Now, they said, "Ed, how do you know that was Ark?" He said, "Well, I didn't get to go all the way to it. He got to a distance. They were kind of up above it, and it was in the late afternoon." He said they were going to try to get down to it the next morning, but when they woke up the next morning, it began to snow, the weather turned bad, and they said, "There's no way we can get down, we can't see, and we have to turn around and go back."
Mm.
But Ed said that he saw it in two levels. One was kind of perched on a ledge, and another portion of it had broken in two, and it was kind of across the valley, perched on the other side. He said it had three levels that he could see very distinctly inside, with cages inside. And he gave a very accurate description of what the ark should look like. And it's people like Ed Davis and others that we have eyewitness accounts over history. And I'm talking, we can go all the way back to Josephus and Marco Polo and a lot of these guys who wrote about it in their day.
Hmm.
And they said something was on Greater Ararat. So the evidence is all pointing to Greater Ararat. Now, if they find it on Mount Judi in Iran and it's never on Ararat, you know what? That's fine with me. I'm not saying it's on Ararat, we have to find it on Ararat. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the evidence that we're seeing is pointing to Greater Ararat, not anywhere else. So that's why we're looking and really concentrating on Greater Ararat in eastern Turkey.
Hmm. So the And I guess I should know this. I should have done this in pre-preparation, so forgive me for having to ask. The expedition took place when, or is it still forthcoming?
Well, the expedition with the film team that filmed this was in 2013.
Okay.
And 2014, of course, we weren't able to go back. The situation changes over there, you know, minute by minute. And there's a lot of permissions that have to be obtained. As a matter of fact, we had been the only team in the last, up until 2013, for the last 3 years consecutively that has had exclusive permission to search for the Ark.
Mm-hmm.
But to get that kind of permission is not easy or simple.
No, again, you're in a border region between eastern Turkey, western Armenia. Azerbaijan is a little portion of its country that extends up into that area. And, of course, yeah. Iran is on the far side of the mountains. So there are a lot of – and as you mentioned, it is a Kurdish area too. So you've got the Kurds involved in the decision to get up there. So was there a specific point in the mountain that – you wanted to focus on it? And I ask because I would assume, and this is something outside my area of expertise, never having climbed a mountain, never having any desire, frankly, to climb a mountain. But I would assume that when you're having to walk like 3 miles up into the sky, you're going to want to make sure you take the shortest safe route possible and not waste a lot of time, you know, doing a grid search or anything like that. You're going to try to plan it for as strategic a route as possible. So how did you select the area of the mountain that you chose to search?
Well, our area that we really wanted to concentrate on was the Eastern Plateau, the Eastern Summit. And to, you know, to get up there, you have to go up the south side of the mountain, which is the way every sports climber that climbs just to the summit and back has to go. And so that's the established route for the summit. And of course, you know, once you get to the summit, you go down and then go up and then go around and then you finally get over to the Eastern Plateau, which is, you know, another, I don't know, an hour or two walk. when I got on the summit, it was miserable. The conditions were just so miserable. You couldn't see hardly, and the wind was sideways, and automatically you go into survival mode. I can tell you that. This old boy from Texas, you know, was
it's a little different weather, yeah.
17,000 feet, because I am not a mountaineer either, but I sure trained really hard for 3 months to go do that. But we really wanted to concentrate on the Eastern Summit, where, you know, some of the satellite data was pointing to. So that's where we really concentrated. And like I said, you're on a glacier. You're living on a glacier, and there's multiple glaciers up to 200 feet thick. And there's, I think, up to 200 different types of glaciers up on the mountain there. And it's one of the largest land masses in the world. And you're on a slope that's sliding down to the Hoare Gorge. It's deeper than the Grand Canyon. So there's nothing easy about it at all. And so once we got up to the Eastern Plateau, we knew where the seasons had been, where the digs had been in the seasons before. Although it was my first time up there, we had a great drill team that had been up there in the past, a father and son team by the name of Bill and Will Hughes, and then one of my archaeological friend and colleague, Bruce Hall, who was his first time to climb. And you know, and that was essentially our ice core drill team. And let me tell you, that's some laborious work. I did everything up there that you could do. I pulled that GPR sled. You have to harness it to your back, and you have to pull that thing. You know, and we don't have a lot of oxygen. That's hard to do. I got on that drill core and drilled, and I took notes. I just did everything possible, because you're really, you know, everything that you have to double and triple up on is very important. Everybody's got essential and very critical jobs to do to make it work. And the Kurdish people, you know, that were helping us, the locals there that live on the mountain, they were such wonderful people. They really helped us, and we just couldn't do it without their help. And you just make some tremendous friendships with the people there. The people, you know, what I've learned in my world travels is that, you know, the people, most of the people are good. They have very simple lives. they open up their homes and they make you their tea and they, you know, and they're just very humble, simple people, and they're happy. It's the governments that really, you know, throw a monkey wrench into that a lot of times. And I think that's what I've seen personally, but the Kurdish people were really, really, warm-hearted towards us. And it really makes that possible on a logistical scale, because you're depending on their horses and you're depending on them to, you know, to help support those logistics. And you just don't walk up to that camp. There's multiple camps, and you know, the people who climb Everest, I've learned that you just don't climb Everest. You have to go from one camp and you base camp, you know, to acclimate, and then you go up to the next high camp and then you come down. You have to climb the thing like five times before you ever climb to the summit, because you have to acclimate at the different camps. And that's certainly what we did as we went up. But yeah, the Eastern Plateau was a target search for the 2013 season.
So what about the geology of that range made it a logical place for the Ark to come to rest, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we had the film screening in Dallas for the cast and crew. It wasn't a premiere. It was a screening. So, you know, they could show us, okay, here's where we're at with the film. You know, what do we need to change? What do we need to look at? We had question and answer time. And one of the questions was from the audience was that, and we had about 700 people come to the screening, VIPs and people that could attend. We had about four theaters that we rented out for this thing. And one of the questions was that, you know, why did the Ark land on top of Greater Ararat at 17,000 feet? And you know, how did this happen? It's volcanic in nature. And yes, all that's true. I'm not a geologist, but here's what geologists have said about this, is that back in during that time frame, there's a lot of debate on the time frame, but let's go back, you know, 4,500 years, 4,200 years, whatever time frame that you want to give it, because there's a lot of debate on that. But let's just say 4,500 years to keep it simple. Yes, Noah's Ark did come to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Now, if it happened to land on Greater Ararat would have only been about 10,000 feet at that time.
Oh, okay.
It's only in the last several thousand years, because it's volcanic in nature, is that it has risen up to the present level of where it's at now. And we see evidence of you know, the Rocky Mountains and other things that says, okay, we have very jagged edges and things are you know, much there's not a lot of evidence of erosion that we see. So you know, given over the time frame of a couple of thousand years old, this has really risen up to the current, you know, almost at 17,000 feet level, which is 16,854 feet exactly. So and then the other question was, well, you know, if it was up there, how come no one's, you know, just disassembled the thing and brought it back down and repurposed it? And the answer to that is because the people who live on that mountain have a high respect for Noah's Ark, and if there's pieces of it that's still intact after the 1840 explosion, the Hoary Gorge blew out in 1840 because of a huge earthquake that happened there, and the volcano became active and it blew that north, you know, east side out of the mountain, and it created the Hoary Gorge. Part of that, there was no Hoary Gorge. There was a monastery at about 7,000 feet. There was about 200 people living in that monastery, and they said that there was some relics from the Ark in that monastery prior to 1840. Well, all those people got killed. The monastery got destroyed, and now that area is deeper than the Grand Canyon. And that's some of the areas that we think maybe part of the Ark is in. It's not all intact. Prior to 1840, people who have written historical accounts about it said they saw one intact structure. After 1840, that has now changed into maybe three or four different pieces. But it's curious that yes, the geology is volcanic in nature there, but again, we have to go back to the reports and to the science that's leading us to an object there on Greater Ararat. Mm.
The technology available to you besides ground penetrating radar, GPS, obviously, there are other things I would assume that are available to you now that weren't to previous expeditions, like, for example, the use of drones, little UAVs. Were you able to use anything like that, and how did they help?
Well, we did have a couple of those. We had a small one that we could mount a camera to that we were able to utilize. However, when you're at the summit, the winds are very strong, and the weather changes on a dime. I'm telling you, about 3 or 3:30 every day, the weather would change, the clouds would come in, the sun would disappear, and that was it. You would just head for your tent if you could find your tent. Our producer, director Brent Baum, was headed to the tent, and he got lost. He got disoriented, and he was actually headed off the Hoar Gorge and realized he was going the wrong way. So the winds are we couldn't really utilize it up there because of the winds that would just, you know, it would take it and just, you know, if it went off the Hoary Gorge, that was it. You know, there's no getting that back. Mm. The larger one we wanted to utilize, which was huge, that we wanted to utilize for that may be able to withstand those winds. We could not get that past customs because they considered it a military
right
device, and plus they didn't want it to fall in the wrong hands and be used against. You know, it's just there's a whole thing over there that, you know, they're very careful about, and that was one of them. So that, you know, did not make it into the country. But we utilized a small one, and you know, even if we could have utilized a larger one up over the Hoary Gorge to kind of look down, it still would have been very difficult to spot. You know, there's such a huge area of land and ice up there that to look at. Matter of fact, what we did in lieu of that was to send two expert alpinist climbers down that side as far as they can go. And it was just the two of them. One of them had summited all the highest summits, had been on some TV commercials, and, you know, this guy knew his stuff. And one of our team members, Holt Calderon, was with him, and he's an experienced climber. And Holt and this other guy went down the Hoary Gorge as far as they could, and man, they were going over crevasses, and it was just – it's dangerous. You'll see some of this in the film. It's amazing what they had to go. I think probably just a handful of people have ever gone on that side and lived to tell about it. Matter of fact, there was a Scottish climber 4 or 5 years ago who was searching for the Ark, went solo. It's kind of like diving. You just don't dive solo. You don't go mountain climbing or hiking solo.
Right.
He didn't have permission to begin with, and no one knew where he was at. Well, he never came back. He disappeared. And they never heard from him again. And it's assumed that he probably fell into a crevasse or fell off the Hoary Gorge. He may never be found. Unfortunately, it's a tragic story. But people die on that mountain, and you have to be vigilant of where you're at and where you're going at all times.
Yeah, no shortcuts. There's some fascinating photos at the website for the film findingnoah.com, and I'm looking at the pictures right now. There's a couple that look like they're taken from inside a vast ice cave, you know, shot upward looking at the inside. Yeah. Is that the gorge that you're talking about, or if not, what was that, and why were you why were guys going down into it?
Yeah, that's one of the crevasses that was on the Eastern Plateau, and when we were setting up our initial grid, that crevasse was about 5 foot wide, and I was guessing about 20-25 foot deep. I couldn't see the bottom. So I told my guys, I said, we are not going across this crevasse. We can't, because it's dangerous. We fall into it. No telling how deep it is. No telling where you're going to stop. We may not ever get you out. So we're not going across this crevasse. Number one, that's kind of a line in the sand, because if there was any arc that crevasse, that crossed that crevasse, that's all you know, going down the Hoar Gorge. And so that was a natural, kind of a natural line in the ice, a fracture in the ice, to say, okay, well, it has to be on this side of the crevasse. It really can't be on the other side because everything's moving. And we sent down some of our expert climbers down that crevasse with ropes and appropriate ice gear. I didn't go down because I'm not one of those guys, but, but some of our guys did, and some of the film team went down. And you know, it actually went down, I think, 35 feet, but it kind of gave us an opportunity to peer, you know, hopefully through the ice down that far, looking towards where we were at on our site to say, hey, is there anything poking out from down below? And that gave us a really neat opportunity. Yeah, it is dangerous. It really is. But those guys, you know, were experts. They know what they're doing, and they went down and was able to look and investigate just to see if there was anything down there that they could see. And of course, you know, the film team went down there and got some beautiful shots.
Oh, yeah.
Of that area. So,
not wanting to divulge anything that you know, you want to hold for the release of the film, and we'll ask about that in just a second, but what was the most surprising thing that you learned during the expedition?
The most surprising thing I learned about the expedition?
Or during the expedition. What, you know, what did you discover that you didn't expect, maybe?
That's interesting. well, I think personally for me was not really through an archaeological, you know, perspective, but really through a personal perspective. And that was, persevering, not giving up. I you know, for me, learning something about me personally was that, you know, it was 4 days before I ever saw the summit when I got to Eastern Turkey, because it was always sucked in by weather and clouds, and you just never could see the summit. And the fourth day, when the clouds broke, it was a sunny day, beautiful, and I saw the summit for the first time, and my heart sank because I realized I'm fixing to have to climb this thing, and I don't know if I can do it. And something that, you know, and I have to say, I nearly gave up. I really did. There was a point in time that, you know, it ceases to become physical, and it all is all mental. And you find a point in yourself that you dig down deep inside, and you press forward, and you don't give up. And for me, every man hits that point at some point. Every person who's climbed that mountain, whatever mountain you're climbing, and it could be a spiritual mountain, by the way, but at any point, every person hits a plateau. They hit where they can't go any further. And I certainly came to my stopping point, and I thought, okay, Lord, I can't do this. I can't do this on my own. I'm really going to have some help here, you know? And it's those, I think, those spiritual moments that you don't rely on yourself because you can't. You have to rely on something greater than you. Mm. And in our case, it's the Lord to say, you know, I'm going to help you through this, and that's where your faith really gets enacted, because now you're really relying on that faith to get you up a literal mountain. And so for me, you know, it was kind of a spiritual journey as well, and learning something about me, learning about the men that you're with. You really create a bond with those men that you're climbing with. And look, I don't know that I would have made it had it not been for that father-son team, Bill and Will Hughes, that were climbing with me. We went in advance of the main team a day before, and it was just us three. Those guys could have taken off and left me, but they didn't. They went at my pace, and I was a lot slower than them. But, you know, we went as a team, and they encouraged me, and they said, Aaron, you got this. Keep going. Yes, it hurts, and yes, it. I mean, we were all hurting, but we climbed it together, and we did it as a team, and we all got to the top as a team. And so for me, I learned something about those men. I learned about character. I learned about perseverance. I learned about what it takes to not give up, and when everything's screaming for you to give up. And so for me, it was I learned a lot in that sense. The other part was, you know, we learned, you know, places where we thought we can narrow it down even more, you know, when we were beginning the work, and places where, you know, we need to be looking at in alternative places. Because remember, we think it's in, you know, broken up in several different sections. So we learned a lot because we know where we've been, what we've done, and then what we need to do. We've ruled out a lot of places already. So even if we don't ever go back, at least advanced or future teams could say, okay, these areas have been ruled out. We know not to go and waste time there. Let's focus in on this area, you know, such as that Ahura Gorge area that may be there. That's where Ed Davis in 1943, he said he went up that Davis, what is now known as the Ed Davis Canyon. Now, it's interesting because since 1943, that thing has changed. Why? Because it is filled up with about 60 to 90 feet of ice since 1943. So it's not all the same. As a matter of fact, there's a story called the Lost Squadron. This is a group of planes that were coming during World War II, and they couldn't make it all the way back. I think they were going back to England. Now they had to ditch the planes in Greenland because they ran out of fuel. And there was about four or five of them, and you can Google this. It's called the Lost Squadron. They ditched these planes on the belly, crash landed on the isle, on Greenland, on you know, basically on an ice, you know, Siberian landscape. Those planes got lost to time since 1943. A group of people said, "We want to go back and find these planes." They found them with ground penetrating radar, and they were not in their original location. They were down 263 feet, I believe, down in the ice, and they were, I think, a half a mile or a mile away from their original location because they were in a glacier and that thing moved the planes. What's interesting is they found them all, and they went down through the ice, and they were able to disassemble the planes by pieces and pull them out of the ice. They have one of those planes fully restored and flyable. Yeah. It's a very neat story, but the point is that since 1943, there's been a lot of ice buildup, and so it makes it very difficult to search in those areas.
Yeah, this I've read about that. That was the flight of six P-38 Lightnings and a couple of B-17 bombers from Greenland that were supposed to get over to, and they wound up crashing in Greenland. And over 260 feet down in the ice, and they've restored one of the P-38s. And you can find that online at creation.com. Has got a story on this at the Creation Ministries International website. Fascinating stuff, and the search, regardless of what it turns up, is fascinating. As you say, you learn things that you wouldn't even expect to encounter. Or consider when you're doing all of the planning and preparation and strategizing for the search. Finding Noah, the film, when is it going to be released?
That's the million dollar question. We don't have a release date for the film yet. We think it's going to be this year. We're very confident it will be this year, 2015. It will be a documentary theatrical release, and there's a lot of work that went into this film. It went across, I think, 10 different countries, 15 different states, expert interviews, never before filmed footage in very difficult areas of access. It's filmed in high definition. It is going to be a worthy documentary. When I get the release date, I'll be able to post it on my website at aaronjudkins.com. And, you know, it's interesting that I was, doing my thing in front of the camera, you know, with one of the as a consulting archaeologist on the team. But I was also involved as associate producer behind the camera. and learn lots of things there. But we're working very hard. I know the guys at the office in Los Angeles have been working day and night on this, and it's a massive project. But we're needing about 300,000 likes on Facebook. So if you go to facebook.com/findingNoahfilm, we're needing a lot of traction with the film. Mm-hmm. We need your support and those 300,000 likes. And of course, if you go to the website at findingnoah.com, that'll lead you to all the social media. Plus, we have we got some updates coming on the website as well. It's going through an update process. But we have the film trailer up now that you can see. We're adding photos and we're adding some character trailers that showcases some of the crew. Bruce Hall, one of the archaeologists, Holt Cauldron, his trailer is up now. So if you go to the website findingnoah.com, you'll see these updates, and you'll see as over the next several weeks we'll be updating even more to the website. But we're needing about 300,000 likes on Facebook, so that would really help us out tremendously.
Well, 300,000 less one now, as I clicked on it while we were talking here. AaronJudkins.com is your website, and you've got a book coming out, Quest for Noah's Ark Expedition Journal. When will that be available?
It's available now.
Okay.
It's not a book, it's a journal. And look, it was a journal that I wrote personally. It was just for my personal thing. It's my account of kind of the day-to-day, you know, expedition, what I did, what we did, you know, what happened. And but people ask me, would I consider putting that, you know, out? And after, you know, much, you know, thought on it, I decided to do that. So that journal is available now at AaronJudkins.com. And it's, like I said, it's not a book. It's not chapters and verses. And, you know, it's a journal. It's got daily entries. It's got photographs. It's meant to be kind of an old-fashioned handwritten journal, but I decided to go ahead and make that public so people could be able to see it and kind of get a firsthand account of what it's like on one of these expeditions. But we hope when the film comes out that, you know, you'll tell your friends and your family about the film, and you never know. You know, there's a lot of films coming out in the Hollywood industry now that has really caught on with the Bible and the Bible stories. We know a lot of these films are not accurate, not biblically accurate. They're not really historically accurate, but they're entertainment. We're hoping that a film such as this documentary film, Finding Noah, will really bring back, you know, some good, honest film that you know you can take your family to go see, and it's about a group of intrepid explorers searching for one of the greatest archaeological finds ever, and that is a search for Noah's Ark. Mm.
Finding Noah is the film, findingnoah.com, the website, and our guest, Dr. Aaron Judkins. Aaron, we'll talk with you again as soon as that film is ready to go.
Thank you for having me on. I'm sorry I'm just recovering from the flu here, but it's always a pleasure to be on your program, and thank you for the opportunity. And by the way, I had you and Sharon on Epic Voyages on my program and debuting her new book on Ebola and the fourth Horseman.
So yeah, and tell people, and forgive me, because you know, bad host for not remembering to ask you about that. Epic Voyages Radio on the Inception Radio Network. Where do people find that?
If they go to InceptionRadioNetwork.com,
okay.
Or they can go to my website, AaronJudkins.com. I got it linked up there. But the show's live every Monday night. I guest host the show just once a month on Monday night. Matter of fact, tomorrow night, Monday night, which will be February the 23rd, I'll be hosting the program live. So, and we're adding some live streaming to the show. So, lots of new updates there. And then it gets re-aired on Friday nights on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And so, it's kind of a neat thing to do. I just do it, you know, once a month. But I really enjoy doing the show. And I had you and Sharon on last month. Talking about her new book, mm-hmm. And what an awesome guest, you know, you and her were. Right. I really appreciate that. We had a lot of great response from the both of you, and I thought the book was just a tremendous body of work that she did on that. And I really encourage people to go to your website and buy that book. What a great work that y'all have done together. And I know that you're looking forward to working over at the ministry over yes. at with yes. Tom Horn and Gary Stearman.
Yeah, Skywatch TV. Yeah, I'm just happy that people are figuring out now, finding out what I've known for the last 17 years, which is that Sharon K. Gilbert is the smartest person I know. So
y'all are awesome.
Well, and my father, well, I thank you very much. But, you know, as my father said to me more than once, son, you married up. And he was absolutely right. Aaron, we'll talk with you again soon.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on.
All right, brother. Check the show notes at vftb.net, and there'll be a link there, of course, to aaronjudkins.com and also to the website for the film, findingnoah.com. Now, by the time you hear this, because I'm recording this in advance, this is the afternoon of February 22nd, so this, by the time you hear this, will be March the 1st, a week later. Don't have a schedule upcoming for A View from the Bunker, because we're in the process of relocating. Tried to work as far ahead as I could. But only so much one can do while trying to work around the last days of completing the my time with my previous employer, making arrangements to move, showing the house, getting the house ready to sell, things like that. But there are some interesting possibilities in the works, including a possibility that we'll be able to talk to filmmakers behind the forthcoming documentary. In fact, I shouldn't say forthcoming because it's already been shown in a limited theatrical release. The film Patterns of Evidence, which Sharon and I mentioned on the Gilbert House Fellowship, Sunday the 22nd. We talked about Joseph as we studied the book of Genesis chapters 37 through 42, and the possibility that the remains of a statue, which had been really defaced, almost destroyed, at the ancient city of Avaris, might be a statue of the biblical Joseph. Anyway, made preliminary contact with the filmmakers behind the film, Patterns of Evidence, which examines in a broader scope the evidence in Egypt for the existence, the presence of the Israelites, the Hebrews, and then the Exodus itself, their departure on the way to the Holy Land. That's been kind of a big sticking point for Egyptologists, because the belief among mainstream Egyptologists and historians is that there's not been any evidence whatsoever of the presence of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of Hebrews in the land of Egypt during the 400 years between the time of Jacob arriving with his sons and the time of Moses. But what they found in the course of the film is that the evidence is there if you toss out your presuppositions about the chronology of the history of Egypt and start from the evidence and then work backward, rather than trying to make evidence fit into a time period that has already been predetermined. So hopefully we'll be able to get that to you soon, and we'll have more programs on the way as we settle into our new location in the Ozarks. It means going to have to record the introduction, re-record the introduction to this program, as it's no longer on a cul-de-sac anymore. Anyhow, that is still ahead. Mentioned the Gilbert House Fellowship. Please join us every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Central Time. And now that we're on daylight savings, that's UTC-5. The website is gilberthouse.org, as we continue going through the Bible chronologically in order of the dates of the authorship of the books, rather than their order in the Bible itself. So we hope you can join us for that. And if you can't, then check out the archives and subscribe to the podcast at gilberthouse.org. Review from the Bunker on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you happen to pick up this program. We sure appreciate your assistance in that regard, because reviews help with the search algorithms and would certainly help this program to show up a little higher in the search results. We have no delusions that we'll ever replace, say, Joel Osteen at the top of the Christianity podcasts, but if we can just get the message even to a few more people and show them that there is perhaps a different way of looking at the world through a biblical lens, through the lens of biblical Christianity, we sure appreciate your contribution toward that goal, because that's really why we do this. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.